Blog Talk Radio.
Up there beyond the sky, it's been a long
For the spot and tap on, towing the canyon for life, the rifle edge of the zone. us. Rudy Giuliani trying to blind me, but I see reality. Was raised with the street mentality. My strategy's why my battery never died. The ghetto kept me wise, so I would never fall to the lies. It's no surprise, but do or die if you want the glamour. Yeah, I want the glamour, laid out with cheese and trees in Atlanta. My Cuban smoked out like Ron Weisey with her banners. The hammer in the palm, never shaky, calm handlers. This renegade blow through barricades like grenades. I turn the sun to shades in the night back to day. Like the 24-hour rotation, I know the location. It's just a little information. From this war, ringing the terror for the now era. And let it rain on your fine leather, nigga, what?
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, People's Political Party National Chairman, Brother Nat Turner, and co-host, our Minister of Communication, Sister Amina, as well as myself, National Minister of the Motherland, calling each and every Tuesday night. Same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to be a part of our conversation to participate. Tonight's topic, who said they was leaders, part 3. We're going to open up the lines to our host, People's Political Party, National Chairman, Nat Turner, black power, black power. Can you hear me, Chairman?
Yes, sir, black power, black power.
Black power.
Right on, man. On the third leg of this topic, you know, who said there were black leaders? Up to this point, and we covered the beginning of what was shaped and structured as black leadership. The unseen forces that some of us may know as the families that the powerful families that run the corporate world, power, finance, industry, commerce, trade, control, the wage market on its various tentacles, it is what it is, and this is a attempt to, just expose, our people. Those who are listening to the mechanisms that operate behind the scenes that fabricate black leadership. The state has had no choice in creating what could be perceived as black leadership because, at some point, the black collective masses, coming out of physical slavery, would eventually be molded into something. And so they were very aware of that. And if there was going to be some type of leadership that would be beyond the scope or the pale of the white ruling class inheritors of the massive capital that was reaped off the back, blood, sweat, and tears of the Africans who were forced violently into the slave economy, the slave system, the slave market, which shaped American capitalism as we know it today, which has expanded into an empire, imperialistic endeavors, ambitions, around the world. And here within the jurisdiction of this country, it became protocol to continue to corral probably the most threatening group of all the rest of the so-called non-whites in this country. And so you know, we went from that era post physical slavery reconstruction on into the rolling 20s, you know, the time of Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, the founding of the Boule, known in the collegiate, black collegiate world as Sigma Pi Phi, 1904. The 3 years later, several years later, the founding of the NAACP, of whom we are told was W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a member of the Boule. On into the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, an antagonistic aversion to the great Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who reintroduced the black surplus population of America to some type of Africanity, some type of identity, reestablishing links with the motherland. Garvey recognizing the white ruling class operatives who exploited Africa for its natural resources, and particularly diamonds and gold, on into the oil accumulation, plutonium, which is one of the Anglo-American establishment's most prized possessions, because without plutonium, the Europeans in their leading countries, often referred to as the G-whatever, G7, G9, G-whatever, the NATO countries, which is referred to as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which established itself on the heels of these wars, World War One, World War Two, which was no more than the division of the spoils, the carving up of the earth among the European nations, being some black and brown and people, black and brown indigenous people of the earth, which represent the majority population on the planet. And so their ambitions call for making sure that they're constantly in control of whatever the non-white groups that are here, and particularly in America, specifically what is referred to as black people. And so on into the Jim Crow era, 50s to 60s, and the continual fabrication of what has been presented to the massive collection of a collective of black people in this country, you know, as leadership in the guise of civil rights leadership, which is no more nor less than a deal that was struck between the state and those who had been given the reins to be leadership in the various forms of media, corporate controlled media. These individuals were referred to by Malcolm X as the Big Six. Some of these were J. Philip Randolph, Martin Luther King, Whitney Young, people of that nature. And these is the same elements that were instructed to get in front of the March on Washington, that those of us who are politically conscious sometimes referred to as the farce on Washington. And this is how Martin Luther King ended up being the figurehead in his I Have a Dream speech. The other one of these individuals, the Big Six, was John Lewis, who, as a matter of fact, recently passed. And this, if I'm not in error, this slogan about good trouble. Lewis emerged from the group SNCC, which stood for Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was later changed to the Student National Coordinating Committee under the leadership of the badass, goddamn fucking revolutionary, A-Trap Brown, who, as we speak today, is a current political prisoner, Abdul Jamil El-Amin, Imam El-Amin. And the portion of the beacon, those who were slated to speak, and one of these is John Lewis, who in his draft of a speech, when it was gone over or what have you, he was approached to alter the speech, change certain terminologies in the speech, and the one who did the most is A. Philip Randolph. And Lewis acquiesced in even in his anger. And as strange as that may be, Malcolm X referred to him as one of the Big Six. And so out of that is the assassination of Martin Luther King by the military arm, military industrial complex of the United States government. And of course, the Patsy James Earl Ray, you know, given the charge of the assassination of Martin Luther King. We left off there and want to sort of kind of elaborate on that some, because there were a number of other things that I think I should at least mention somewhat. The original intentions of the King, the initial place where they were supposedly staying was at one of the plush hotels downtown. And word got out to the FBI director, J. Hoover, and Hoover sought to exploit the fact that King and them were staying at a plush hotel downtown. And some of us had always wondered how that news got out besides the media. And as a counter strategy to the attempt on the part of J. Edgar Hoover's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO for short, Kingdom moved to get a motel in a lesser exquisite area, no more than just a counter move because of what had been done. And it is believed that these photos that some of us may have seen, where King is at the motel, photographer who had been taking these photos of King is said to have been the FBI informant who leaked this information to the FBI. And that is how Martin Luther King ended up at the Lorraine Motel. and some other things. Recently, speaking with a comrade of mine, was explaining to me how the military had, you know, been doing certain surveillance on the day of and even during the assassinations, so which therefore would tell us that they knew what time it was. Reverend Billy Cowles, one of the ministers up on the balcony with King some years ago, was speaking at an event, which I believe was some type of event in commemoration of Dr. King. And out of his own mouth, Billy Cowles is explaining to the audience that where exactly he was standing in relation to Dr. King. He said that, well, as I was standing here and Dr. King was standing next to me, and I moved over so they can get a good shot. That's when the shot rang out of his own mouth. Dick Gregory was informed of that and had gotten hold of what I believe is a video. And Dick Gregory had himself been suspicious of certain elements within King's camp and had spoken subliminally about certain individuals, and we believe one of these individuals is Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson himself had went up to King's lifeless body and stuck his hand in King's blood and wiped it on his shirt and appeared on TV a day or two later. And when explaining how the blood was on his shirt, he claimed to have been holding King in his lap and told a contradiction to what Andrew Young had said and witnessed with his own eyes as he was up there laying on the ground or sitting on the ground right by King's body. And so who was supposed to inherit the leadership between such individuals as Benjamin Hooks, Ralph Abernathy, and an aide of King's who is now famously known as Jesse Jackson? If you look at Jesse Jackson's colorful past, you'll find a number of things in his history, and there's no coincidence. Jesse Jackson became the new face of the leadership, the assassination of Martin Luther King, who in the end had realized his philosophy was flawed. Parallel to leading a people into a burning building. And so off the heels of that, we had Jesse Jackson. And those of us who've been around long enough remember Jesse Jackson in the 70s and the 80s. And, of course, Jesse Jackson's bid for the presidency, I think, in the 84. And at the time, Jesse Jackson had been befriended or had established a sort of a relationship in solidarity with Minister Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. And there was a statement at one point in time, of course, Minister Farrakhan was accused of anti-Semitism, and Jesse Jackson himself had made this comment about Hymettown in New York, which is a reference, a subliminal shot at the white Jewish people, who, it is a fact, have a share in the power collective in this country, in virtually every branch of wealth getting there is. And so Jesse Jackson at some point had began to distance himself from Farrakhan And up to this point, he had become the face of black leadership. And there are several groups who are not necessarily given priority to, of which we find and discovered that Jesse Jackson had become a member of. And one of these groups is believed to be the quasi-clandestine group referred to as the Trilateral Mission. The Trilateral Mission was basically the brainchild of Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, and agents of Big New Brzezinski, whose daughter, as a matter of fact, you may find on, I believe this is CNBC news in the morning, the early morning show, NBC, founded in the early 70s. And this group itself operates, of course, the word tri means three. And this is one of the groups that basically dictate the real agenda of America and the other imperialist nations in their conquest referred to as globalization. And Jesse Jackson, of course, is very well informed of this globalizing scheme. It was no coincidence that Jesse Jackson has been in the past and more recently making trips outside the country involved in the American imperialist international policy, or what they policy, or what they refer to as American interests abroad. And that is no more nor less than just fancy jargon, neatly packaged cosmetics for the true and real intentions of exploiting the natural resources of foreign lands by any means necessary. During the Iran hostage crisis, Jesse Jackson was instrumental in that, having made a trip to Iran. And the whole hostage crisis was a scheme, a ploy set up by the CIA and this government to embarrass President Jimmy Carter. And at the inauguration, the swearing in of Ronald Reagan, the next day the hostages were free, which wasn't a coincidence. Jesse Jackson was in on that, contrary to popular opinion. It's a number of things that he has been involved in. I had been told some years ago at the prestigious University of Tulane by a Caucasian European, somehow, some kind of way, you know, this conversation about leadership. And I was reading him the Riot Act. He decided to counter with Jesse Jackson. Little did he know that I was not a fan of Jesse Jackson. He assumed that I was because I'm black and Jesse Jackson is black. But anyway, he imparted to me that one of the things that Jesse Jackson had done was with the Coca-Cola bottling company, which has the patent on the syrup, and that Jesse Jackson had received one of the patents, Coca-Cola, and put it in his brother's name. And I was told this information years ago. But as I said, he has been the instrumental leader in the 80s and the 90s. There's a thing that Jackie Robinson, I've mentioned before, when he had spoke of the fact that if it was not all the leadership, he was sure that it was most of them who were what he referred to as Rockefeller men. And one of these appears to be Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson was also a recipient of the Spingarn Award. The Spingarn Award was named after Joe Spingarn and his brother Arthur Spingarn, who well, the true power behind the NAACP on the board of directors, and there's also involvement of the one of them being a military intelligence officer. Also, Jesse Jackson's relationship with the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the sister branch of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which connects the East Atlantic with the West Atlantic from the East Coast of America to the West Coast of what is referred to as the British Isles, Greater Britain, under the monarchy of the so-called Queen. And this is the link that establishes what's called the Anglo-American Establishment, which is the head of the European nations, who are now known as NATO. And these are the same nation states that also partition Africa among themselves, what has been referred to as the Scramble for Africa. And this is how the colonies of Africa and the jurisdictional boundaries were set up on the part of the Europeans. The French controlled a huge chunk of North Africa, which later on led to the Algerian Revolution and the liberation of the Algerian population or people in Northwest Africa. And in other parts of Africa, Southern Africa, the Boers, British. As a matter of fact, these two white factions went to war over the spoils, and the British emerged on top. You have German East Africa. You have Belgium, Congo, in which the great rubber industry, the Euro-American tire companies, had embellished themselves. The name that you see on the tires that some of you all may have bought as B.F. Goodrich or Thomas Goodyear. And this is how they were able to gain massive wealth from the exploitation of the rubber resources in the Congo. And the king of Belgium, Leopold. And if you go to Belgium today, you can see the exquisite monuments that have been built. The infrastructure of Belgium is owed to the slavery of the Congolese brothers and sisters in the heart of Africa. Until the emergence in the 1950s, of one Patrice Lumumba. And this is another one of the brothers who Malcolm X had spoken of as a young African who was charismatic, who did not bow down, who did not acquiesce to the monarchy. And as a matter of fact, in this speech that he had made in front of the Belgian ruler at that time. And some say that that was the writing on the wall for Patrice Lumumba, who was later murdered, betrayed by one of his own, who had become the ruler of Congo known as Mobutu, who had lavished himself with millions and millions of dollars, U.S. currency, or the British pound. And he had bank accounts here in America. And he lived lavishly while his people lived in perpetual misery. And that is the difference between Lumumba and Mobutu. And we can make parallels here, right here in America, which is what Malcolm X had did when he was speaking. And so we move on into the 80s and the 90s, of course. And, you know, these things can be quite complicated. very complex. Some of these so-called leaders have learned the Hegelian tactic, and the Hegelian tactic derives from a German philosopher named George Hegel, who lived in the late 18th, early 19th century, and this tactic or strategy of making the left and the right work in unison together undercover without in the open overtly appearing to be political adversaries, whether Republican or Democrat. This is why these presidential agents of the state who have made it a habit or routine to appease certain segments of Black America with these appointments in office, in some cases becoming the first this and the first that, Colin Powell, the first highest ranking military officer, individuals such as L. Douglas Wilder becoming the governor of Virginia, Mayor David Dinkins of New York, Obama appointed Lanny Gounier, whose father was a member of the Boule, Joshua Gounier. And so it is no coincidence that these individuals are chosen from this particular group. There's also a female group known as the Lynx. And a lot of these female politicians, representatives, and civil rights activists, as Jackie Robinson had stated, if not all of them, most of them, were members of such female versions as the Lynx. Marion Wright, I think it's Marion Wright Edelman, somewhere close to that. But it is no coincidence that, again, that these individuals are chosen, you know, from these organizations. There's actually a children's version of it, referred to as the Jack and Jill of America, where the so-called elite intellectuals, intelligentsia, that W.E.B. Du Bois referred to as a talent and tent, their children to sort of, according to them, gain their children some type of Black identity. Of course, having been put in the in the future, this world of whiteness, you know, in private schools, boarding schools, or what have you. From Jesse Jackson, the torch appears to have been passed to one Reverend Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton emerges out of the late 80s, particularly with some of us may remember as the Tawana Brawley case, where the young Black woman had accused a group of white males of rape. And this is how Al Sharpton had came into the limelight, and then the murder of Yusuf Hawkins in Bensonhurst, which is pretty much an Italian enclave in Brooklyn, New York. And these are the two incidents which had set Al Sharpton off into the national realm of leadership. But there are other things about Al Sharpton that we are not necessarily privy to, or exposed to. One of those is Al Sharpton at one point having tried to or attempted to get into the drug game. And there's a video of Al Sharpton, surveillance video of Al Sharpton, who, to my understanding, is having a dialogue over the importation of cocaine. And this person who Al Sharpton had been speaking with just so happened to have been an undercover agent, FBI agent. And so from that point on, things began to look a little murky for OL. And there's also the point, of course, with that, you know, there are those who have drawn the conclusion that Al Sharpton had become an FBI informant. Over the years, Al Sharpton had gotten himself into the position of being the head of a group which still exists today, referred to as the National Action Network. And he and Jesse Jackson in the media, of course, their being black was most likely the driving point of the media reports, stories, what have you, leaked emails, communications back and forth, where Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton had become known as shakedown artists. And what was meant by that was basically Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson had been shaking down corporations who had been known to practice discriminatory ways within their corporations, or discriminatory practices, about hiring practices, about you know, needing basically, you know, some type of quotas. And Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton had exploited that, and over the years they had begun to receive check after check after check after check. And one example is can be seen with Al Sharpton, where $500,000 had come as a contribution to this nonprofit in New York referred to as Education Reform Now. And when that money was received from that nonprofit, it immediately was transferred to Sharpton's group name, National Action Network, supposedly to fund the group's so-called educational equality agenda. While at the same time or simultaneously, this corporate entity referred to as Plainfield Asset Management was seeking a $250 million stake in what's referred to as Capital Plate, which itself is a group who was seeking to secure a license to run what's called the Racino, pretty much, you know, the horse racing, legalized gambling in Queens. And it just so happened to be that Capital Plate hired a lobbyist whose name is Charlie King, who just so happened to be an executive director of National Action Network. And this is in 2008. A year later, Mann had also racked up another $100,000 from AEG Consortium, which was the successor of Capital Plate. And even on Sharpton's 60th birthday, he raised $1 million from the likes of AT&T, McDonald's, Verizon, and Walmart. There's also been times where he gained financial resources from Macy's, Pfizer, General Motors, China, and Chrysler. And this is the type of moves that Sharpton and Jesse Jackson had become famous for in the white corporate controlled media. And of course, some can see these tactics and strategies as a divisive method, but there's also those of us who take the information and are able to put it in perspective, regardless if Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson is liked or not liked. The purpose is, what we're saying here is that, again, who said they were black leaders? Who made them black leaders? And there's no coincidence that the same. What we got, Conrad? What we got?
Got a caller, Chairman.
Okay, right. Let's get the call in. Let's get him in, Conrad. What we got?
Black Power. Go ahead, 205.
Black Power.
Give us your name and tell me where you called him from, brother or sister.
Oh, this,
go ahead,
brother Leon.
Okay.
Brother Leon, local chair of People's Political Party, and I was just calling in just to say, you know, that this so-called black leadership, you know, and you know, how it has trickled down to the day. And, you know, and I think some of the stuff I recall we was the mayor, you know, what referred to, we, you know, New Orleans mayor, election, and we referred to as Cantrell, you know, y'all may say Cantrell, and how we was out there one day, and we were doing some, you know, just doing some observation and some, you know, and seeing, you know, being, you know, looking at the political landscape in terms of land grab, gentrification in the area, what they call Castle Haley, and where so-called leadership popped up in the, you know, the truck, you know, what we call, they say they call President of the Urban League. And I want you to expand on that, that also, Brother National Chairman Nat Turner, on how it has come down to today's leadership, even some of those at the bottom are understanding this hill. They are being transformed before our eyes. Even in the, you know, young man, you know, and family lost their little children in the river, and a brother kind of like woke up to this so-called leadership, black leadership, and exposed them, you know, on a small level, but really it was a large level. It went to the heart of the world. And I'm gonna listen to you and talk, you know, expand more on it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're speaking on a local level, you know, but those who, you know, may not have gotten it fully. On a local level, you know, we're talking about the mayor of New Orleans, the first so-called black woman mayor elected. You know, we see her position here is no more nor less than an agent of the corporate entities that are here as we speak today, land grabbing the city of New Orleans, you know, displacing the local black population, which has been in the majority for years. You know, over 67% of the population in New Orleans haven't been, you know, those persons of African descent. And we understand in the political realm, you know, political campaign contributions, which, of course, can be used to dominate the airwaves, commercial space, you know, audio, visual, or billboard, you know, and to socially engineer the local population. You know, it's never been about one who attains the most marketable success during the campaign. It's never been that person. It's always been the one who the state understands that doesn't sponsor. Or again, you know, you'd have to be a fool to think that the state is going to sabotage itself. So this is a local politics. When you have local politics, we talk about such things as industry, commerce, revitalization, or what you want to call it, redevelopment or development, enhancement from a business perspective with the white private sector. And so in the midst of that, you have contracts. You know, and these contracts, you know, you have bids. And so the highest bidder. And that money trickles down to the various players in the game. And so as a part of that, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you say, Coontrail. It could be Coontrail's sorority sister. And let us also point out that Coontrail is not a native New Orleanian. She's a transplant into the city, you see. And so she's learned the game to be very shrewd, sort of Machiavellian-like, you know. She's adapted the white Western strategy of, you know, bullshit and jive, you know, the rhetoric, you know. And what the people always seem to forget or tend to forget consistently is that the spontaneous reaction on their part from the rhetoric moves so fast that they're unable to realize that they're being gamed. They're being had. You know, they're being lulled to sleep by somebody who looks like them, and especially black women in the city of New Orleans. You know, when it was Obama, it was especially black men, you know, on the federal level, on the national level. You know, so what we're talking about here on a national scale is what you're bringing up on a local scale. And, of course, you know, you can put class into the equation because it's always the lower class people, like the rap group, the rap duo in Atlanta referred to itself as Outkast, you know. In Russian language, revolutionary Russian language, the lumpen proletariat, the lumpen, those who are considered to be the scum of the earth, those who will scheme their way to gain monetary resources, or, you know, those who would be the so-called criminal population, what we know in the so-called hood is hustling, you know, and it's the American way. There's no way that America could function, or the white ruling class sector and their middle-class white suburbia could exist without crime. Crime and politics are synonymous, even though on the surface they appear to be totally different. But there's no way that you can separate politics from crime. There's anybody on this earth, you know, I can bypass staying in the city or the state, no, on earth, who can refute that or prove it to the people. Otherwise, feel free to do so. You know, in military parlance and military circles and military language, there's this thing about war is not about who's right. It's about who's left. That is left standing when the smoke clears. So on a local level, you had the pigs, the arm of the state, making war on the local population. The descendants of the surplus population that came out of physical slavery, you know, here in the South, the Southern Belt. And so she has to play her role. And, of course, there are those of us who believe that the reason why, because the state has something on her somewhere, some kind of way. You know, and she's not willing to make that sacrifice like Malcolm X did. You know? And so the concern over the three young children of God, the God we know, is problematic. You know, there are those who are blaming the parents. And you can look at that again as a class issue. You see, but that is the reason why we understand capitalism to be the cancer of society. But because of the cosmetics or the trappings of so-called civilization, it appears to be the greatest system that so-called man came up with. But unbeknownst to them, or little do they understand, due to the bullshit, a handful of people. And this extends, you know, back to Western Europe, you know, where even the poor whites were at odds with the white ruling class who ruled over them. And they were white. So you can only imagine if they felt some kind of way how black people should feel. But it just so happened to be that energy is there, and every time it starts to brew, the state goes into action, and it pulls out those who you know, fabricated as a leadership, to cool the population down, to cool the populace down. And that is what Malcolm X was talking about, what happened with the so-called March on Washington, that they had no control over it. The initial march, the initial gathering, was because of the brewing of all the frustration that had built up. It's to be seen like when you take a I remember when I was a boy, a youth, Coke, you know, drinking the Coke was very strong, you know, the acid. And so I couldn't drink a Coke like I can today. You know, the acid, of course, it seemed like it was, you know, acid, you know, like tearing your throat up. And so what I used to do, I would put the top on it and I would shake it up until it cooled down the acid in the Coke. Now, I would have to wait a few moments because if you take the top back off, it would shoot off because, of the fierceness of the acid in the soft drink. And so I would have to turn it upside down to cool it out for a while and then turn it right back and slowly loosen the cap. And it would rise up and it wouldn't go no further than the top of the open. And that's the leadership. That's what the leadership has done in America. You know, the people is the Coke being shaken up. The leadership is the person that has the Coke bottle in his hand. And he does what I just described until he knows when to take the top off because he knows it's not going to rise no further than the top of the lid. And then he can drink it with ease. And that's what it is. And so if you look at the rostrum of all of those who have been selected to these positions in government, made history, local, state, and federal. If you take Susan Rice, you know, who had become a U.S. ambassador. You know, I remember when Robert Mugabe, who was the liberator of Zimbabwe from the British, and they had never given up on reconfiscating Zimbabwe to this day. And they would put her in the action. And Robert Mugabe would just simply say such things like, oh, that poor little Negro girl, you know, going to work again for her master. That's how he referred to her. Condoleezza Rice, whom the great Dr. Abdul Khalid Muhammad, what referred to as Condoleezza Rice. And she was pretty much like the brain child behind the Bush gang. You know, Richard Pearl, Some people know him as Donald Rumsfeld. Others of us know him as Donald Scumsfeld. You know, Richard Cheney. You know, Dick Cheney, who was the head man of Halliburton. And who was Halliburton? Halliburton was the prophets of war, particularly Iraq, Afghanistan. You know, that the military went in, destroyed the infrastructure, and that was worth billions of dollars to revitalize, to rebuild the Iraqi infrastructure. And so when you wash my back, I wash your back. You know, it's like you my frat brother. Okay, you go in with a sledgehammer and sledgehammer the shit out of the walls, and I come up in there and I'm a damn carpenter. I get the contract. Later on, we end up on a yacht somewhere in Belize. You know, I hand you a check. Job well done. Who we got next? Oh, shit, Iran, Syria. You know, in the meantime, the black leadership is doing what? You know, siphoning off some of the proceeds in exchange for what? Keeping the niggas out there while they overseas, cooling us out. Eldridge Cleaver, who was National Men's Information of the Black Panther Party, referred to as what he called shelling out the gold. You know, to cool you out. And this is where we at today. So from Al Sharpton, his strategy of, you know, literally there's emails, transcripts of Al Sharpton, you know, speaking to the CEOs of corporations, Sony, you know, corporations such as that. As a matter of fact, Sony, recently as Obama, one of its heads, a female head, was heard saying, making these racial disparaging remarks about Obama or that. So who did it? Did you get a meeting with Al Sharpton at the hotel? You know, did it make the news? Did any of this hear about it? So, you know, he's look where he's at today. He has his own gig on MSNBC. As a matter of fact, I'd say MSNBC with Brzezinski's daughter, who's on the news. Brzezinski was one of the brain trust behind the Trilateral Commission. He's been the same man that I'm speaking about, who has this funny last name, as though, you know, he's Russian or German somewhere up in there, you know, his family lineage. This is the same man that you can see in the photo with the group that became known as Al-Qaeda. You know, holding a AK-47 in the photo with the Mujahideen, you know, which was Osama bin Laden's org. You know? And so Jesse Jackson, the Negro bourgeoisie leadership / some of the black petty bourgeoisie. You know, everybody's not a member, just like everybody's not a member of the Boule. They function from the Boule to, you know, the fraternities, you know. And Charles Wesley, you know, he wrote the books on the fraternities and the Black Masons and all this type of stuff, Black Elks and all that. And they, you know, stated the purpose of keeping the Negro intellectuals away from Garvey. And see, in a revolutionary struggle, in its inception, you know, ideologically, you know, it tends to depend on, you know, the petty bourgeoisie intellectuals who understand these different isms, you know, and their elevation level is pressurized by the masses of the people who become agitated, you know, who become stirred up. You know, to that highest point of revolutionary ideology or overthrow. And so the state understands it. So, well, let's cut the shit out before it gets, you know, out of hand. It was once an ant hill. Okay, shit's a mound. But we know that a hill is, you know, larger than a mound. You know, so when it gets to mound stage, you know, it's a little alarm there. And so what do? You you feed them. So you know, as I would say, you know, you make history. You know, so from Jesse Jackson to Al Sharpton to who now? You know, Sharpton's cooling out on MSNBC. Some show he called Keeping It Real with Al Sharpton. I mean, the most ludicrous title, Keeping It Real with Al Sharpton. And that's something he snatched from the streets, you know. And so from Sharpton to who? Such individuals, Eric Michael Dyson, Cornel West. I myself had a chance encounter with the great Cornel West at the prestigious Tulane University. Packed house. And he was up in there shooting his shit, you know. And, you know, sort of Hegelian like. You know, and he had made this comment about, let's talk about the demons, don't get talked about, use some Greek bird and shit, you know. You know, to show his range of knowledge, you know. And I said, okay, that's good. I'm glad you mentioned. So I scribbled down the stuff that I scratched out the stuff that I had there, waiting for the question to answer. And I wrote down some names, you know, some of these family names and some of these groups. And before I could say one word, he had already realized what type of energy my presence was bringing. And before I can say one word, when I stepped at the mic right out of the gate, oh, yeah, now what you want? You know, like, you know, attitude out of the gate, you know? You know, I mean, I didn't buy into it. And I just simply repeated what he had said. I said, you had made a comment about, you know, the things that, let's talk about the things that don't get talked about. I said, okay. I said, I thought that was right on time. I said, well, I got a list of names. I want to see if you can relate to this. You can, you know, elaborate on some of these names and, you know, explain this to these young people in this building. So I went to San Rockefeller, Morgan, Vanderbilt, Chase, you know, you know, Harriman's. Carnegie, Rothschild, Schiff, Warburg, Oppenheimer, Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, Jacob Group, Club of Rome, and all these different things. And he was just like, okay, he got more heated. He got more fired up, you know, and he was, something about, oh, you just want your little 3 minutes of fame, because you know that's what it is, huh? But he, you know, his counter move to get around actually going into it was going after me. But the crowd, as I was naming these names, you could hear the crowd, you know, making these, like, you know, ooh, you know, you could hear them, you know. The crowd was on it. But they was looking at him, you know. So even in the end, you know, they were even more hostile, you know, towards me, you know. He wouldn't even shake my hand coming down the aisle, you know. And that right there, it said, lead by example, observation be participation, you know. And so it is what it is. Tavis Smiley, he has his annual black conference or what have you, you know, contract with Black America. Okay, what Black America are you talking about? You know, the same strategy, you know, white corporate finance from the private sector. Walmart, McDonald's, the same corporate entities who sponsor, by the way, Black History Month, you know? They're the ones who control the narrative on who the leadership is, who's going to be known nationally through the commercials and the billboards and the, you know, they give these little spots and these little minute commercials, you know, and, you know, you know what I'm saying? But you never hear them talk about Garvey. You never hear them speak about Malcolm X, you know, H-Rap Brown, you know, Stokely Carmichael. You know, the Republic of New Africa, Amare Obadeli, Assata Shakur, even Queen Mother Moore, you know, who was a Garveyite, you know, and lived all the way up until the 60s, you know, so they controlled the narrative. So who said they were leadership? Who said that was leadership? Who said that was black leaders? Who said it? You know? And so the individuals who turn about Tavis Smiley's annual vendors act that's put on, you know, shown nationally, internationally by C-SPAN. And you know, these panel discussions, you know? Eric Michael Dyson is a sure bet. You know, look at Lamont Hill, you know, Temple. He has his own show on what is now the Black News Channel, whatever that is, Black News Network, whatever, you know. He was formerly working for us, I believe, CNN, and he went too far with the white Jewish segment of the white ruling class by making a reference to the apartheid that's going on in Palestine with the Arab population at the dominance of the Israelis. And he was out of there. You know? So some of these things are tactics to win appeal from the masses of the people, the streets, you know, the working class blacks, you know, who you will find in you know, in New Orleans, and there's second lines. You know? And now you have what? The post-George Floyd phenomenon, Oprah Winfrey. You know, her two-part series on her channel OWN, calling herself gathering black leaders and asking the questions of what do we want, what are our demands, where who are you talking about? And some of these same individuals, you know, the black petty bourgeoisie, African Senate, you know, to be promoted as the new leaders, new 21st century leaders, you know. Some radicalism, you know, the tanks of militancy, you know, dreadlocked up, you know, doing the Kwanzaa thing, even African spirituality. You know, shit, in the 60s, Deborah Johnson, was known then, the mother of Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., the Black Panther Cubs, was known as, referred to as my mom, you know, a cool in jail. She said that they referred to those individuals as armchair revolutionaries. You know, and the nerve of Oprah Winfrey to try to insert herself in this new black post-George Floyd leadership, gathering, you know, the new black intelligentsia from the universities. You know, and some of these are the same authors or collaborators of the 1619 Project that the white conservatives, right-wing conservatives, Republicans, are raising hell over, you know, teaching sedition, you know. Well, if the black petty bourgeoisie is teaching sedition, and what the hell is the revolutionaries teaching? You know? And so it could be a bit tricky. You know, some it's understood in these circles that our leash extends as far as radicalism, some militancy. You know, but the call for the overthrow of the capitalist system is betrayal. And this is the direction that Johnson was being led to believe that King was headed in. And so therefore his assassination. You know? Other individuals who have emerged out of the woodwork, you know, with that wee shit. And, of course, individuals such as Benjamin Crump, you know, and then he went and dug out the old fossil, Al Sharpton. And Sharpton shows up at, you know, doing the eulogy or what have you, the, you know, funeral and some other individuals. And, you know, And so this present population of young people, youth and boys and girls, you know, again, you know, they're being, in the movie Total Recall, what they refer to as lobotomized, you know, socially engineered. And at present, we have the black militant organizations, you know, boots on the ground, you know, black power groups today, you know, that are emerging. But even in the midst of that, there's infiltration. Black Lives Matter is infiltration. The confiscation of the Black Lives Matter, of course, getting ahead of it, seeing which direction is, okay, well, let's get ahead of it. You know, the news media can prop them up as black militants, because there's certain elements, you know, one or two individuals in the Black Lives Matter movement that taking on this militant persona. You know, and at one point, you had Black Lives Matter members turning up dead, and they all shared the same form of death, being murdered, and then their bodies being burned in cars. You know? And the black population can look at that and say, okay, well, yeah, right on, you know, that shit, you know, militants. Again, the state is forced to choose. Now, it's gotten higher in a sense, but the state is forced to choose it once more. They're either going to choose the black militant revolutionary, you know, AR-15 totem, shotgun totem, you know, or they're going to choose like the lesser of two threats. And of course, they're forced to choose Black Lives Matter. And of course, you know, to dump financial resources into it. You know, individuals such as George Soros, who's an internationalist, through his what's called open society, the infiltration of Russia to open up Russia, to open up Russia's economy to the West, to the international Anglo-American establishment-led, you know, capitalist structure. You know, in the meantime, betting on breaking which government's going to crash or go into bankruptcy or, you know, fail with his economy. And that's what you call legal betting. That's what George Soros has done. He's known in certain circles as the man who broke the Bank of England. You know? And so he take those resources and play the left and the right. You know, he's perceived to hate George Bush, but that's entertainment. And that's Machiavellian. You know, if you look at their ideology, it's the same. You take Trump and Obama's ideology, it's the same. They both, okay, he's black, he's white. Okay, y'all, okay, you know, motherfuckers call that black, white shit all the time. But you're so blind that you can't see the other shit that's driving him is driving him. Because they both know how far their leeches extend out. When not Donald Trump, he's a risk taker. You know? So he's gaining popularity because he's exploiting what, you know, the shadow government has done, ripping off, you know, the American job infrastructure. He's taking advantage of it. And that's why he's winning mass appeal by, okay, well, you know, America first. I mean, who wouldn't go for that right now? So, well, we got somebody. Okay, I thought, but yeah, you know, it is what it is. That's you, Leon?
Nah, we good. That was me, Chairman. We good, Black Power, as you were.
Okay. Yeah, but you know, so this is where we at, and so all of these individuals somehow, some kind of way, is connected with the establishment, you know, to control or stem the tide, which is inevitable. The black revolutionary movement, the black liberation movement, which has had its struggles, you know, which has gone through certain cataclysms, and certain of us who are still around maybe hanging on by a thread or two, you know, and, but not in all cases, you know. And so understanding, you know, what we've been through and this new hour drama that's been added to what's referred to already as empire that has, you know, socially engineered the black populace in primetime TV. And now they've added the hour drama referred to as I Kind of People. And this I Kind of People title was snatched from the book I Kind of People, written by Lawrence Otis Graham, who is a member of the Boule, and who explains in this book, you know, who many of these individuals are families extending way back, you know, in the 1880s and 90s, you know. And, you know, he says, for men, there are also exclusive, hard-to-crack social groups. At the top of the list is Sigma Pi Phi, known simply as the Boule, which admits professional men once they have distinguished themselves in society. It was founded in 1906, I say 1904, and its early membership included W.E.B. Du Bois chapters that have since been established as the most major cities, initiating such men as Washington attorney Vernon Jordan. Vernon Jordan went on to be chosen by the Clinton administration to make history, or to make black people feel included in the democratic process. That was their reward. You voted for me, I'm giving you a black so-and-so, this and so on. And Vernon Jordan is my choice. And Vernon Jordan went on to become one of the managing directors of what's known as Lazar Ferris. If you look up Lazar Ferris, these are the internationalists, you know, the banking cartels, you know, which is part of the what we can say is a shadow government. You know, the globalists, Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young, Urban League President Hugh Price, Virginia Governor L. Douglas Wilder, and American Express President Kenneth Chenault, as well as most black college presidents and the most prominent black physicians, attorneys, dentists, and corporate leaders in any major city. He says, when I joined the group, the once secret organization became an important bond for me and a wide circle of friends. Other elite groups for men include the Guardsmen, the Fellas, the Comas, and 100 black men. And as with the sororities, there are select college fraternities that are held in high esteem, the Alphas, the Kappas, and the Omegas. Mm-hmm. And so whenever the Europeans want to make history, you know, with black people, you know, they just go to their Rolodex of names, and they choose. You know, so who's the latest? You know? You know, some would refer, you know, the first black woman Supreme Court judge. They had already made history with the men, the Thurgood Marshall. You know, you see the so-called first. I mean, she can go under any title or adjective or name, whatever. You know, first woman of color vice president, the first black female, whatever, vice president, you know, the first biracial or what have you, vice president. I mean, she can wear any of those hats. You know, it is what it is. John Henry Clark, the great John Henry Clark, who happened to be one of the members of Malcolm X's secret research team that many of us didn't know, had made this speech called "We Have No Friends," and he was talking about, you know, the other groups, you know, with somehow some kind of weird scene that have exploited us, even though they appear to be at odds with each other. Now you can take a look at the, you know, the Latino people, You know, that's why we on the more expanded, like we say, black and brown people, black and brown indigenous people of the earth. You know? But when you look at what he said, you know, you can take that in the sense of, you know, within the black population. You know, who are our friends? You know, when it comes to, you know, the leadership. You know, who's our friends? Who do we have? You know, and, and just for the record, one of the members of the female, the Lynx, which was founded in 1946, you know, well-to-do matrons, you know, the women. And he says that, so his granddaddy is, you know, his mother was inducted as a member along with Dr. Betty Shabazz, the wife, the widow of Malcolm X, you know, and a host of other accomplished women, you know. And I mentioned Marion Wright Edelman, you know, former Spelman College president, Junita Cole, Secretary of Energy, Hazel O'Leary. And so the state has kept what people like Carnegie initiated as the group that was going to be the leadership of the black displaced masses who had pretty much been left for dead at the you know, the hands of the police apparatus of the capitalist system. And you cannot understand the police if you don't understand capitalism. And you won't understand capitalism unless you understand police. They go hand in glove. You know, and this is where we at with it. And so we say that, like the Black Panther Party, the genius of E.P. Newton, to declare those who not genuinely with us on a more synthetic level, the enemies of the people. And who is the people? You know, the people are those who, you know, out there in these communities, the same people, you know, who are relegated as the niggers, you know, on these rap songs, you know. One of Snoop Dogg's songs on his Doggy Dog or Dog Pound album, whatever, you know, his one album that set him off into the stratosphere, you know, where the, you know, the hook is, you know, to all my niggas and my bitches, you know, niggas and the bitches everywhere, you know, the same outcast or exploited, you know, source of labor people that every 4 years they have to depend on. You know, but when the same people come under attack, they're nowhere to be found to defend them, you know. And I say that every 4 years we should pull away from that shit and let them fend for themselves and go our own way and take our minds back from them. But it's going to start with individuals, you know, such as the People's Political Party and other groups that are out there to have a clear understanding, you know, a politicized, correct view of the situation, you know, that can, you know, articulate, you know, this thing to the masses of the people and finding a way to say it, to get us in the right direction. And of course, it's the struggle. You know, you dare to struggle, you dare to win. And so we feel as the People's Political Party that we're on the right track, and that we plan on staying on the right track. And we know that along the way, we're going to take some hits. You know, we are also normal, regular brothers and sisters. You know, some of us are married. You know what I'm saying? Or have children, you know, go and take part in the working class system. Taxpayers by force. You know, the descendants of the Africans who were forced to build America's economic infrastructure and therefore the rightful inheritors of his wealth in the name of reparation. You know, so this shit about giving black people stuff for free is bullshit. You know? You can't give us anything for free. It's already ours. So they do us no favor on Christmas or what have you, you know. They do us no favor at all. Labor Day, whatever. It's already ours. It belongs to us anyway. You know, we get excited and yeah, you know, hey man, they around the corner giving this, that, so on, so on. What FEMA did for the victims of Hurricane America in Louisiana, you know, FEMA checks. It's ours anyway. You know, it belongs to us anyway. This shit is ours. We're the inheritors of it. The whites are the ones who got the shit for free. The present descendants of the slave drivers, they've inherited the shit for free. They haven't paid no dues. We have. And the most exploited, the true and real beast of burden has been the black woman. She is the ultimate beast of burden. And so, you know, we hope, and I hope personally that we were able to get through and that, you know, hopefully we've done a good job and we will revisit some of this in the near future as we move forward, you know. And so on that note, we want to thank, you know, those who have been listening or those who may have been listening, whether small or large, you know, and stay tuned for next week's show, 7 p.m. Central Time, 8 p.m. Eastern, In Defense of the People Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. You know what I'm saying? And on that note, brother, you can take us out, you know, with a tune. Have at it, my brother.
Black power.
Consciousness. Without human consciousness, there is no world. It is the presence of human consciousness that brings meaning into the world. Without human beings in this world, conscious human beings in this world, in effect, there would not be a world. We bring the world into being through our consciousness. And through our consciousness, we create the world we live in. Out of the totality of reality, our consciousness cuts out a world that's a bit itself. In other words, the kind of world you exist in reflects the kind of consciousness that you have. And notice, if you change your consciousness or change your values and orientation, you enter into a different world. You interact with different people. People often that you didn't even know existed in the world. Social situations that you might not have even recognized until you entered into a new level of consciousness. You see people, say, for instance, who become addicted, say, to crack or something, and now enter into a whole world and enter into a whole social system that before they became addicted, they hardly noticed. They didn't know what it was all about. And they picked up new friends and new relations, whole new ways of acting.